This is Aged in Kentucky. I'm Rhonda Miller with a series of stories about people and places that have been in the bluegrass state a few years or many decades. Each one has a unique spirit. Brother Paul Quinnan is a Trappist monk who entered the Abbey of Gethsemane in Nelson County in 1958 at the age of 17. His spiritual mentor was Thomas Merton, who's regarded as one of the most influential writers of the 20th century, with more than 40 books on contemplation, mysticism, social issues, and world religions. I talked with Brother Paul at the Abbey, where he loves to walk amid the peaceful hills called Knobs near Bardstown. He immerses himself in the elements of nature that emerge throughout his writings. Quinnan has written a memoir, In Praise of the Useless Life, as well as several books of poetry, one of those with the title, Amounting to Nothing.
Sorry monk that I am, I never amounted to nothing. Somebody must have laid a curse on me and said, you'll never amount to nothing, which was my life ambition. But I'm still too much of something. So this is, there's a kind of an undercurrent of a mystical tradition there. That is where, and especially like in Zen Buddhism, where you just lose slough off the ego, and these false outer selves that we contrive for ourselves to get along in society or to get ahead in the world, and amounting to nothing is, the ultimate degree of humility is to, be as so free of myself that God can fill the self. I'm made for God, and I'm full of myself. So what I have to do is get past that, and then let what may seem to be nothing. God is not a thing. So the presence of God, in a way, is negative compared to the other experiences that we have in life. So that's that's kind of the deeper aspect of that whole thought about amounting to nothing.
Thank you for offering that poem, because I was going to ask you to read it, but you offered it spontaneously. You've been in Kentucky a long time. Do you think that being in Kentucky or the atmosphere or the land or anything has influenced you?
Oh, well, yes, definitely. I mean, not that I've seen much of Kentucky other than the acreage around the monastery. We are living in what you call the Knobs. These are, small hills, and there's nothing particularly magnificent about them, but there's something compelling, and a lot of forests and open fields, and we're very fortunate that way because it's all quite lovely, really. And you can go walking on an afternoon just west of the monastery or east of it and not run into another soul. I mean, we've got that, 2,350 acres.
How do you think you and the brothers here and the Trappist monks can sort of help people who are just, it almost seems like scrambling, in society. Everybody is too busy. Everybody's on the clock. Everybody's on their phone and their, their iPads. And for many people, it's considered advantageous to be too busy. And always busy, and always doing something and always being something and having a title or a job or something. And yet, how do you think what you were just speaking about, amounting to nothing, which is kind of the goal, how do you think from here that might be able to help people in society with all the stresses and, the mental illnesses and the anxiety? And is there a way to offer that wisdom to people?
Well, they can come and see it. And we have a retreat house, and it has capacity of about 35, 36, something like that. That will increase by the end of the year. And so people come and spend maybe 3-4 days with us. They enter into the prayer life that goes on in church 8 times a day, and enter into the atmosphere of silence that we live in. We have a busy lives. You know, everybody has a job. We're supposed to do contributing to the monastic economy, but it's not what you would call in the world a full-time job. The ideal is that we work 4 hours a day, and then the rest of the day is spent in reading, prayer, or whatever. And so it is a very regular schedule. We're busy, but the fact that it is so regular and not broken up gets you into a kind of a rhythm. A rhythm is a good way of, you know, settling the soul. That's you know, rhythm in music gets you into the music. Rhythm in your daily life gets you into your daily life. But it can also be boring, and that's part of the point. You know, it's not an exciting life. We take on boredom as part of the medicine of our life, because that requires you to go inward. Instead of being excited by outward events, you go inward, and that's the whole purpose of, you know, we're supposed to be living the prayer life and living in a quiet presence to the Lord, because the Lord is in quiet presence to us.
And so people would say, gee, working 4 hours a day, that sounds nice. How do I, you know, pay my bills? And I'm wondering, some people come and, take part in the retreats and maybe reflect, but do you think people can take something from that in their, you know, in their lives, in society, when they're working and raising families and paying their bills and, you know, running around at a high speed of a high speed of existence, which may or may not really be a high speed in the way things, you know, are important?
Well, yes, I think it's possible to, you know, to focus on the chief observances of our life. That is, reading, especially scripture, sacred spiritual reading, what we call lectio divina, divine reading, prayer, regular prayer, saying the psalms, going to mass, if you're a Catholic, and, you know, simple manual labor, if that's possible. So, you know, meditation, spend time meditation, time praying, time working. So those are takeaways.
And in the years you've been here, I guess I'll just have to ask you how long you've been here and how old you are now. Were there times when you thought, is this right? Should I be doing this at, you know, at 20 or 30 or 40 or 50? Or, you know, were there times that you thought, is this the right thing that I chose?
Well, I've had times where I thought it was too comfortable, that we were too much a reflection of the affluent middle-class society, and I wanted to live something poorer. I wanted to maybe live in inner city, do something like the Catholic Worker Movement does. And I had, the abbot was understanding enough to let me go to a third world country and to stay at a monastery and help the monks there, teach them. I had received my master's degree in systematic theology by then. So I went to Nigeria, and I lived at the monastery there for a couple years and taught the monks, and experience was good. It was what I wanted to get away from our kind of culture of affluence to one where they really do have to struggle. And so that was a good learning experience. I have to say that I didn't think it was my life, though. So I figured, well, I should live the life that I dedicated myself to. I took my solemn vows here, one of which was the vow of stability, to remain in the monastery for the rest of my life. That's one of the vows that Benedictines and Cistercians make. So it was a good experience to have that. Right now, I'm in my 82nd year. I'm 81 years old, and
What is your birthday?
November 12th.
19.
So I'm a Scorpio.
Yeah. November 12th,
1940.
And did you take that solemn vow of stability at 17? I assume there's a process where you're here for a while and then you take that vow?
Yeah, there's a process. Yeah. You have two and a half years as in the novitiate, and then you got 3 years in temporary vows. So you do take the vows, you know, at that point. I was 28 years old when I took solemn vows. So it took me 10 years to get through the process. And, you know, some people ask me if, you know, do I want to become a hermit? I love being in a hermitage and spending time in hermitage, like a whole week for once a year. But I'm too gregarious to be a good hermit. And the other thing that, you know, the other takeaway that you could have about monastic life is that we do this together. It is a community. You can get away with 4 hours of work a day when everybody is collaborating. We pay our way. We don't depend that much, well, really, on donations. The donations we get mostly get passed on to other people in need. We have a budget for that. We just decided that we'll send $50,000 to the people at Mayfield. And, you know, we have a rather generous charity budget for local people and also international requests.
So that $50,000 to Mayfield is to help people affected by the tornadoes?
Yeah, that's right, those affected by the tornado.
That's great, yeah. You said everybody has a job or work. Do you have a specific work here?
Oh, I've been cooking for about 35 years.
Oh.
And we support ourselves by making fruitcake and fudge, and all that work is done by the monks themselves. And it's enough to get us by, really. And then we, of course, have the gift shop and the retreat house. And people, you know, they make donations when they come to the retreat house. So those are three big sources of income. I don't think the income from books are that great. It's decent, but, the majority of our income comes from the mail order products that we make.
Right. So your main job, the hours that you work, the 4 hours, you're a cook?
Yes. They either think I'm not capable of anything else, and they might as well put them in the kitchen, or I haven't been so bad that they kicked me out of the kitchen. Or whenever I've been kicked out of the kitchen, the abbot wants to bring me back sooner or later.
Do you have a special recipe or special dish that people like the best or is your favorite?
Oh, I don't know. I used to think pizza was my favorite, and then we started buying the pizzas and dressing them up a bit. So I can't really say. The thing about cooking is that you can be creative with it, and there's always, a new twist or something. So I don't get into a rut.
You've been in Kentucky a long time. Do you think that being in Kentucky or the atmosphere or the land or anything has influenced you? Because I know you're also a writer and you've written many books. So do you think Kentucky has had an influence on you?
Oh, well, yes, definitely. I mean, not that I've seen much of Kentucky other than the acreage around the monastery. We are living in what you call the Knobs. These are, small hills, and there's nothing particularly magnificent about them, but there's something compelling about them, and a lot of forests and open fields, and we're very fortunate that way because it's all quite lovely, really, and you can go walking on an afternoon just west of the monastery or east of it and not run into another soul. I mean, we've got that, 2,350 acres. And so you can experience solitude by going out in the woods for an afternoon. And I meditate outdoors because I find it very congenial to be outdoors during meditation. And there's just something about, And I really like being outdoors a lot. Sometimes when I'm, you know, meditating, I'll get an idea for a haiku. I like to write the, you know, the short Japanese three-line poem, you know, with... So, to me, it helps to make concrete the whatever I'm experiencing at the time. I mean, not necessarily a spiritual experience, but a spiritual awareness of the, you know, concrete, you know, physical sensations that I'm having at the time. And I'll give you an example of that. Here's one haiku. Ragged cow bellows, pray like the psalmist, desire, frustration, and rage. That's one. And here's
what
another.
What was that? Pray like the what?
The psalmist. You know, we say the psalms every day. If you're familiar with the psalmist, that's pretty much the lineup. Desire, frustration, and rage. And a lot of other things, too. But that's... Here's another one. Perfectly round moon goes down with a smile. Old cow gets quieted down.
Great. Now, these are handwritten in your note, in your book?
Well, I carry this little pocketbook to write down these haiku as they come to me. And then I'll take them and revise them and put them together in a collection. Roosters early on with hilarity, early up merrymaking.
A lot of your poems, or many of your poems, are about birds and nature and all kinds of creatures who probably live around here, right?
Yeah. Well, yes, and so that's, you know, that's just part of living in the country, I appreciate it. I would say that the outer surroundings of the landscape here is seamless with my inner landscape. My soul and the world around me, just as I experience it from day to day, from season to season, from year to year, have etched themselves into my soul. And of course, you're projecting that too all the time. Your appreciation of anything has to engage your mind and your heart. So it's like I have an inner and outer existence, which is, in a way, one existence.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I'm sure many people might love to feel that. It sounds very peaceful.
And, that's the advantage of growing old in one place, because, you know, you become very, very familiar. You know what to expect from the seasons, and you know... when it's, you know, as it is now, it's not the way it used to be, and so I'm very much aware of that. I'm very much aware of the fact that I do not hear frogs anymore. Very rarely do I hear the frogs.
Was there a time that changed that you noticed?
I think it was about 2 years ago. And, of course, then I found out there's a kind of a plague among the frogs worldwide. That's part of it. But I suspected it was climate change that brought that about.
Have you noticed other things about the weather or anything since you've been here? That's an interesting, you know, observation, really.
Oh, well, yes. I think we've had an unusual amount of rain for the last 2 years here. More than usual. I mean, it used to be we'd go into real droughts in the 60s where the ground would crack up, and I haven't seen that in a good while. So, I mean, in a way, Kentucky is the place to be during global warming. I was saying that because, you know, our summers are less hot than they used to be, and the winters are less cold than they used to be, and we don't get the tornadoes now. That has changed, and we do get tornadoes now.
Yeah. And you've been a writer for quite a long time, and do you consider that part of your daily life, or I know you've written many books. How many books have you written, and how do you see being a writer as part of your just life here?
Well, I didn't publish my first book until I was 54 years old, and that was a book of poetry, and since then I've, I don't know, it's hard to keep count, about 8 or 10 books of poetry, and I'm working on another book right now. And then some of those were collections. They were anthologies. I cooperated with another poet in putting that together.
And you have a memoir, too, right?
Yeah, the memoir, In Praise of the Useless Life. It's kind of like St. Thomas More's In Praise of Folly. So apparently people really like the book. They'll read it more than once, which I don't understand why anybody would read a book more than once. So the next book after that was How to Be.
And that has just recently come out?
Yes, that came out in November.
Okay, good.
With Hampton Road Press. And then I did another book with two other monks. It's called Holy Folly, Short and Tall Tales from the Abbey of Gethsemane.
You seem to like to make people laugh, I guess, about your titles and your books and your the apparent contradictions that maybe aren't really contradictions, right?
Well, yes, something that's catchy, and I haven't thought of a good title for my next book. Right now I'm going through my journals and picking out what might be salvageable and rewriting it, and hopefully that could be eventually published.
You do notice how the frogs have disappeared and maybe the seasons have changed a little bit. Do you think people have changed? I know people come here to visit and they come on retreats, and you know, people, I guess when you first came here, I guess we assume people lived a simpler life, but I'm not sure if that's really true. But do you think people have changed? Because it seems like, I don't know, it just seems like people are kind of been rushing, and they've been rushing through life for a long time. I'm just wondering if you see differences, because you have, I guess, quite a lot of people coming here to visit.
Well, yes, I'm an advantage, because the most interesting people come here. And, you know, for one thing, people are much more willing to show affection. I find that, of course, that a lot of that took place during the 70s. That's a change.
You mean they'll come and be friendlier or hug you?
Yeah, I mean, they'll hug, you know, and they're much more, you know, confidential with things. I think, at least maybe it's just because this is a monastery, but when they're overworked, they know they are. They're aware that there's something out of balance. And maybe that's not true with everybody. But, you know, the people who come here tend to be spiritually inclined. And I think people are more open-minded. Of course, you know, the whole ecumenical movement has changed people's attitude, Catholics' attitude towards other religions. Most of the friends I know are interested in Buddhism or something like that.
I was going to ask if people of other religions come on your retreats.
Oh, well, the retreat house, we take in, we get all kinds. And a good number of them are Protestants. And I suppose you get some, that's mostly what I hear about. The funny thing is that last week there was a group of Amish people who came to get a talk. And that, I think, is pretty unusual. There were young people, and then there were two men, adults, you know, kind of who came, and I gave them a talk on, I said, well, we'll talk about God and talk about silence. You know, so that's where I started out.
Were they young, like young adults, or younger than that?
Yes, they were young people, and then there were two, you know, older men. But, you know, they're sort of like, you know, in their teens and maybe early 20s.
They also live in a very, you know, in community.
Well, yes, they're very much like us in many ways, a very tight tight community life. And, you know, they really intend to live poor, to live a poor life. And at one point he said, for us, obedience is very important. Obedience and poverty.
As far as the Abbey of Gethsemane here, do you think the Abbey itself being here for so many years, since 1848, correct? It has influenced Kentucky, or do you think Kentucky has influenced its development? I'm kind of wondering if it has had an influence on maybe the state or the surrounding area.
Well, I think it's certainly had an influence, largely a collective influence, because we're living in southern Nelson County, and that's called the Holy Land. It was a kind of a pocket of Catholicism within a Protestant surrounding. And so it was in this area that Bishop Flaget came from France, and the Dominican friars started a, you know, friary. It's St. Rose, not far from here. The Dominican nuns at St. Catherine's, and they had a college there. The Sisters of Loretta, which was an order which was created by the local women with the help of a priest from Belgium, Father Nerinx. And then the Sisters of Charity in Bardstown at Nazareth, the Sisters of Nazareth. And they were a local order, too. They started out sort of on their own back in the 1820s. So the monks came after that. We came in 1848. And it's really kind of continued to be a, you know, Catholic presence. And, you know, especially since we worked the farm, we have worked the farm in the past, well, you relate to the local farmers and the local people. And monastery has been generous, you know, with helping out local people and donations and things like that. That creates a goodwill. And then, of course, with the writings of Thomas Merton, it's not only infected the the state, but the whole country and the whole world, for that matter. And it's kind of a beacon or a city on the hill. You can think of the monastery as a city on the hill, which emits a certain light. It's a community life. We're doing this. And if anybody is interested, they can come and see it. They can come into the church anytime they want and participate in the office. And they come by the busloads in the summertime, or even other times. A lot of college groups come, and they'll attend the office, and they'll want to talk. And then, of course, there's all the retreatants. I say we get maybe 9,000 people a year who come here.
Oh, that's a lot of people. Yeah, it's a lot of visitors. Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm doing is staying in church, you know, singing with everybody else. I mean, that's just a kind of that's not a much. It's a bit of an individual contribution to the evangelizing of the world. But it's a beautiful way of evangelizing. I mean, we're praying. Let them enter into our prayer. That's what they do. I mean, that's so essential. That's so important. And that we share that. And so it's good they come here and they don't get preached at. I think a lot of people appreciate that. We're not out to, you know, make something out of them. We're allowing them to be free and to be sort of self and being introspective for a while, you know, to take a different look at things.
Right. And the, I guess you call it a service that we just heard before this. What is that called, the one I went to?
You just went to Known, Ninth Hour. That's one of the three little hours, terse, sext, and known, and they only take 10 minutes. And then we have Vespers in the evening, and that's like 25 minutes. And then we have Lauds in the morning, and then we have Vigils, which is the longest of the offices, and that starts at 3:15 in the morning. And that's a great time to, because everything's nice and quiet then. Then, of course, we have daily mass, and that's at 6:15 in the morning. And then on Sunday, it's at 10:20.
And all those services are open to the public?
Oh, yeah, it's all open to the public.
I did see people just walking in, yeah. And you were here with Thomas Merton. What kind of impact, I know his book impacted so many people, but what was that like being with him? Did that influence you in any way, many ways?
Oh, well, yes, definitely. I had him for my novice master. So, you know, I was in the novitiate for those two and a half years. And, of course, he would give conferences two or three times a week, and then you would go see him one-on-one every other week, and then just being around the novitiate with us. So it was good. I mean, he was a good-natured and upbeat and witty, and yet he very perceptive and caustic sometimes. And so, you know, I learned to sort of take something of a critical distance from the community life. It's good to be in community, but you don't want to, you know, get submerged in community. It's good to be able to stand in the community and to stand outside the community, to keep your own perspective on things. And, of course, the fact that he was a writer and a poet eventually had an influence on my occupations.
Did he encourage you to write?
You know, when I was a novice, I wrote a poem, and I showed it to him. And, well, he liked it. He put it up on the bulletin board. He liked it enough to show it to the rest of the novices. And so that was an encouragement. But I didn't write a lot of poetry until after he died, and that was in 1968.
I read that there's a belief or a thought that praying in community like this helps the world. Or, you know, the world has a lot of, I guess you would call it, troubles going on. You know, there's always war and starvation and hunger and things like that, and disagreement. But is that something that you think helps from here? I mean, do you pray for the world? Or I'm just wondering if this is something that is a belief, maybe, or a thought.
Oh, well, definitely. I mean, you know, that's our role in the church. The hidden apostolate of prayer. And that's something that we can't prove it has any effect at all. It's something that's based on faith, that God hears prayer, and that God doesn't need to be told about what's going on in the world. Yet at the same time, through compassion, I can enter into, you know, the fire they had in an apartment house in New York, and then one in Philadelphia lately. Well, that's all of that is, you know, part of the burden of prayer that we should be carrying. I'm not sure I carry it as much as I ought to, necessarily. But as a community, we get continual petitions coming in from people with individual needs and cares, and COVID, and somebody died, and that's posted on the bulletin board as, you know, it's topics for monks to be praying about. And the divine office is just not our prayer, not just the prayer of the individual monks in choir. It's not even just the prayer of the choir itself, but it's the prayer of the church. You know, we are carrying on the prayer of the church, as do other monasteries, you know, who have this, you know, really dedicate so much of their life to the liturgy and doing these regular hours in a fulsome way with singing. You know, St. Augustine says that he who sings prays twice. And so you can enter into it more wholeheartedly, because that you're You're physically engaged in what you're doing, along with, you know, a whole community of people. And that psalm that we just had it known, how good and how pleasant it is when brothers live in unity. It is like precious oil upon the head, running down upon the beard of Aaron, the great priest. So there's something more than just ourselves involved. When you do it in unity, when there's this bond, it has a fragrance. You know, it carries beyond just the space we're in. So I think there's something of that. The monastery itself carries a fragrance beyond just what you have here. And some people even experience it when they're driving down the road. They're now they're coming to the monastery. All right away, they can already feel a change in the atmosphere. And I felt that myself. Of course, I'm prejudiced.
that's beautiful. Well, I guess, is there anything generally you would offer to people who are searching or lost or tired or losing hope or tired of dealing with things like COVID all this time? Or, you know, I'm just wondering what you live and, you know, practice all the time that you might offer to people.
Well, it's good to be searching, and we get tired of searching. And the important thing is to realize that God is searching for you. And sometimes God is wondering where you are. You're off somewhere. And so that, you know, we get distracted from what we're doing, and we get discouraged because we place too much importance on our own role in, you know, saving the world, or maybe just saving our little circle of friends or circle of concerns. God knows about all of that. And so to a great extent, it's a matter of leaving that to God. It will be taken care of, and to some extent, it'll take care of itself. All I have to do is be attentive to the role that I have in these things, without giving too much self-importance to it.
How do you think people will know when God is searching for them? Like, will they get a sign, or will they think something, or how will people know God is searching for them?
Well, I think that's where prayer comes in. I mean, if you pray, pray is simply become aware of, as the rule of Saint Benedict, degree of humility number one at the bottom of the ladder is to be aware that God is watching you. God sees you all the time, and that's very consoling. Although it can be kind of terrifying too, given my behavior. And maybe there are signs that can come at certain moments. Everybody has their own little story about that, perhaps. There's this kind of call back to the center. There's a certain kind of need for a refuge. Need for a recourse to something beyond. And this is, you know, expressed in the Psalms, in the shadow of your wings I rejoice, to enter into that shadow of God. And it is a shade. It's not always bright. Sometimes it is. But sometimes it's sort of like entering into a mystery, into a kind of darkness. And there's something congenial with the soul about that, to be able to just abide in. That's why the nights are so important. You know, people maybe have lost a sense of night because we have too much electrical light, you know, around us. We don't really experience night. We don't experience the shadow. But that can be very consoling, especially out in the country.
Well, Brother Paul, thank you so much for speaking with me. It's just been so wonderful.
Well, it's my pleasure.
I've been talking with Brother Paul Quinnen at the Abbey of Gethsemane. For Aged in Kentucky, I'm Rhonda Miller.